Early voting numbers in Texas have been high. Texas still leading in the raw numbers of youth turnout. But what'll that mean come ballot counting time? Today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. What's going on at Texas juvenile detention centers? A new complaint indicates some big concerns. We'll have the details. Plus, 5G is coming, you've probably heard. It means faster speeds, but will it really? And staying home to watch your favorite scary movie is a pandemic-friendly option this Halloween. We'll examine why the Texas Chainsaw Massacre might be the top choice in many homes across the state. We're also celebrating Friday early with a typewriter rodeo and a wrap of the week in Texas politics today on the Texas Standard. From Austin to Luckenbach, Green to Waco. It's the Texas Standard for Thursday, October 29th. I'm Laura Rice, and it's been a hard week for Texas music. Yet another honky-tonk hero hung up his hat yesterday. Billy Joe Shaver died after a stroke. He was 81. Shaver put the outlaw in outlaw country. He's known especially for his writing, penning hits for Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash, among others. Those artists, and just over the weekend, Jerry Jeff Walker, all gone. It got me thinking a bit about Willie Nelson's song, Last Man Standing. I still got a lot of good friends left, and I wonder who the next will be. I don't want to be the last man standing. Or wait a minute, maybe I do. There's no doubt whatever comes next that this particular chapter of music and Texas history will never be the same. Breaking history seems to be what many Texas voters are doing. Record turnout so far in Central Texas and in Houston. But what, if anything, does that actually tell us? Sean Theriault is a professor at UT Austin's Department of Government, specializing in American political institution. Professor Theriault, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
What do you make of some of this record early voting turnout here in Texas?
I gotta say, this is just great for democracy. Right. Texas has always been one of those states that's always at the bottom of the list when we look at voter turnout. And to see us leading, like, that's just tremendous. It's incredible. So it's great for democracy.
So why do you think more voters have been inclined to vote early this year?
My suspicion is that perhaps feelings towards Trump run really high in Texas. So he has definitely a strong base of support, but there's also a strong base of opposition to him. And so I think, right, a lot of this fueling of the turnout is a consequence of just people's reaction to the top of the ticket and the incumbent, the president, Donald J. Trump.
I was expecting you to say something more about the pandemic and people being anxious to get out there and maybe have space to vote. But I guess your point is bigger than mine, which is, well, if there's a pandemic and you don't care at all about the election, then you just don't show up at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic is certainly a story, but I think that the pandemic is playing in other areas in a way a bit more heavy-handed, shall we say, than it is in Texas right now. And the pandemic is across the United States, right? Mm-hmm. Where I think that in Texas right now, I just think a lot of this is just a reaction to Donald Trump.
Well, we obviously can't tell which party this favors until the votes are tallied. But is there anything we can draw from history when it comes to large voter turnout?
Yeah, so usually the rule of thumb is the more people that turn out, the better that helps Democrats. And that's usually because the Democratic coalition is made up of groups that traditionally vote at lower rates. And here I'm thinking of Hispanics and young people. But when we start talking about 65-68% turnout, I'm not sure, right? Like, we're going to wait until Tuesday and what the results tell us. But again, right, like, right, without regard to Democrats or Republicans, I just think it's great for democracy that so many Texans are turning out.
Is there also anything we can draw from where voter turnout is happening across Texas, where we're seeing some of this, these largest numbers?
Yeah, so when we look at the 10 largest counties, what we'll see is that the Republican-leaning counties are turning out at slightly greater rates than Democratic-leaning counties. But before we read too much into that, we should say that that's true across the board. So if we go back to 2016 turnout numbers or 2018, those exact same trends are in place. You're talking about fractions of decimal points to try and tea leaf read. And I just think that we ought to wait until Tuesday to draw too much conclusion from if Democrats or Republicans are going to be helped by this large turnout.
Okay, so this is obviously anything but a typical year. But what do we usually expect as far as like overall percentages, people who vote early in Texas and people who vote on Election Day? And do you think we'll still see that big number on Election Day this year?
Yeah, and that's what we don't know is all this early voting. Normally, we think that a huge early vote just balkanizes your Election Day vote. And I think here the pandemic could be playing a little bit more of a story. I think that people are a little bit, they would avoid lines and crowds if they could, I think, on voting. I think we have a really good indication of what the last day of early voting shows us. Because if we see a huge spike tomorrow in the turnout, then I think that says that there's lots of votes still out there. And we're going to see them on Friday and then again on Tuesday.
So with such an historic amount of people turning up to the polls before Election Day, is it possible we could know, you know, early after the polls close, some indication of how Texas voted?
Yeah, I think that this is where Texas, again, is going to be in the spotlight because we are counting mail-in ballots as they happen because so many of our votes have occurred early voting. I think we could be one of those first big states that's reporting some really concrete and solid numbers. And so I think that we'll learn a whole lot. If Texas is as close as the polls, I think that's probably going to be bad news for the president. But I think, right, if the early vote suggests that Trump is ahead, and then I think that we're in for perhaps a really long night and maybe a long week or a long couple of weeks if we have to wait on Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
Sean Theriault is a professor at UT Austin's Department of Government, specializing in American political institution. Professor Theriault, thank you again.
Oh, thanks so much, Laura.
The Texas Juvenile Justice Department is the agency in charge of the state's juvenile offenders. Children from ages 10 to 17 who've committed a crime can be sent to one of the department's 5 detention centers around the state. But according to a new complaint that 2 Texas justice groups filed with the U.S. Department of Justice, the youth at these facilities routinely suffer sexual assault, violence, and inadequate access to mental health resources. Joining us now to tell us more is Brett Murfish, Director of Youth Justice for Texas Appleseed, one of the groups that filed the complaint. Brett, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Texas Appleseed filed this complaint with another nonprofit justice group, Disability Rights Texas. Some of the statistics in the complaint are shocking. There were over 10 assaults reported per day in these facilities in 2019. The rate of sexual victimization in Texas is significantly higher than the national average. What are the main factors at work here?
Well, you know, the youth that are in TJJD's custody are some of our most vulnerable youth, and they really deserve the best care, and we're really giving them something that's completely inadequate right now. You know, one of the things that has been a persistent pattern is the lack of staffing and the high rate of staff turnover. And that's really due to the remote location of these facilities. They're all in rural areas. They're not close to any bigger communities. And so the department has a really hard time keeping them staffed. And then you have to take into account turnover. So one facility, which is the Gainesville State Schools, what they call it, had a 64% turnover rate. And when you have that lack of personnel, you really do have chaos.
Part of that sounds like just a Texas infrastructure problem, sort of the nature of the state being so large and in large part very rural.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could make that argument, and I don't disagree. I think another element is just that we know more now than we did when we built these facilities. And research shows that children who are at risk and who, you know, need rehabilitation and need mental health services really do better in smaller facilities closer to their home communities if they have to be in custody at all. And I think that, you know, with COVID-19, one thing that's happened is we've had a reassessment of who really needs to be in care. And so when we figure out, okay, who really needs to be in care, who is this going to help? And then we think about what's the best setting. These bigger facilities are not that.
Well, let's get into that systemic part of it a little bit, because the Texas Juvenile Justice Department is the agency that replaced the Texas Youth Commission in 2011. That agency was shut down after children were sexually abused and experienced other mistreatment by staff members. But this report shows the Juvenile Justice Department clearly hasn't fixed all these problems. What else do you think could help explain that?
Yeah, I think that's true, you know, and we've seen a closure of 7 facilities since then, but you've also seen sort of a constant churn of directors because there's no one leader that can fix this broken system. And so we really want to see these constitutional violations taken seriously, investigated. The Department of Justice has the ability to make findings. And then with those, they can come up with a plan with the state to rectify them. And, you know, we want to see that a step further, right? So this is clearly the bare minimum. But what we really want to see is that young people who are in the care of any juvenile justice agency are really helped by it. And we're far from that right now.
Well, as we're talking about what you want to see, we are getting closer to the state's next legislative session. Is there anything lawmakers could do to help address these problems when they reconvene in January?
Yes. I mean, I think putting forward a plan to move away from these bigger state facilities and into smaller facilities in home communities would be certainly a step in the right direction. 5 years ago, the Council of State Governments came out with a report that talks about sort of, you know, how smaller facilities are better for young people, but also how, you know, children that with the same profile who stay in that smaller facility versus go to one of our state facilities do better. And the children in our state facilities end up having a higher rate of recidivism, a higher rate of potential for committing a felony after they get out of care.
So let's get back to that complaint that you all filed with the Department of Justice. Have you heard back, and what are the next steps?
Yeah, so complaints like this are handled in a really deliberative way. And so I am hopeful that we will have an investigation, but I don't have any further information right now.
Brett Murfish is the Director of Youth Justice at Texas Appleseed, a nonprofit justice and legal organization. Brett, thank you again.
Thank you.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar is tracking what Texans are talking about this Thursday. Hello, Wells.
Hello, Laura. Voting, early voting coming to an end tomorrow. And we've reached out to our friends and listeners to see if they've hit the polls already. Here's what we're hearing on our Facebook page. Sherry Kleit says, yes, I hit it on the third day of early voting. The light line was only about 5 minutes. Francisca Harris says she voted absentee and went and tracked to make sure that her signature was approved so her ballot will be counted. Matt Weiss says he voted last week at the American Airlines Center up there in North Texas. Extremely quick, just in and out. And Jim Noble says, after 230 years of doing this in the most prosperous and technically advanced country on earth, you'd think we'd be better at this by now, but here we are standing in line like Soviet-era peasants, Jim writes there. Lots of people, sounds like, have not wait until election day. I've already cast their ballots. What are they casting their ballots for? Well, they're not shy about holding that back. I'll have some reactions later in the program.
All right. We'll check back in with the Talk of Texas in about 35 minutes. You can weigh in on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. You've heard us talk a lot this past week about Latinos and voting. There's good reason. Latinos make up 40% of the Texas population. But any politician who thinks they're going to get the so-called Latino vote ought to be reminded there's no solid Latino bloc. There's huge diversity in experience and opinions. Texas Public Radio's Lauren Terraza spoke with a young, first-generation, first-time Latino voter in Houston.
Oh, aquí estabas con tu maestra. Ya que era kinder.
Juan Venancio and his parents flip through an old photo album in their home in Southwest Houston. Juan poses with his teacher and friends, diploma in hand, from his pre-kindergarten graduation ceremony.
La maestra. Mis matas, me acuerdo yo que sé.
Sí, sí, sí.
The quiet moment is a contrast to the chaos of 2020, from COVID-19 and the economic collapse to the upcoming election. This first-time voter pauses to reflect.
Most people, when they turn 18, they're happy, you know, to get a car, you know, to go to college. And, you know, I was obviously happy to go to college and do these things, become more independent. But one of the things that I was most excited about was being able to vote.
Juan is a 19-year-old first-generation American. He's no stranger to civic engagement, and he credits his parents' immigration experience for that.
Yo me llamo Catalina Elvia Herrera. Nací en Honduras.
Catalina was born in Honduras, and she came here, she says, motivated to get out of poverty.
Mi nombre es Oliverio Venancio y Marcos, y yo soy de México, del estado de Veracruz.
Oliverio is from Veracruz, Mexico. He was planning to come for 1 year. He's been here for 23 years now.
Me vine a trabajar por un año y ya llevo aquí 23 años.
Catalina works in custodial services, and Oliverio is a landscaper. As immigrant workers, they quickly learned fair wages had to be fought for. So Oliverio joined a union called Fe y Justicia, Faith and Justice.
As early as middle school, I would just remember my father, just going out like every Saturday. And it wasn't until he just invited me to go check them out one day that I realized what organizing was. It was the first time that I experienced like the civic engagement up front.
While in high school, Juan was introduced to a new Latino political advocacy group, Mi Familia Vota, My Family Votes. Juan attended one of their weekend workshops at Rice University. The message hooked Juan immediately.
They began explaining why voting was important. They began explaining why suffrage was such an important thing, and especially how a lot of people take that for granted. And it really opened my eyes for the first time for something that most people don't really talk about when you're like 15 or 16 years old.
He's currently studying government and economics at Harvard, and like most students across the country, he's been taking his classes remotely. But studying from home has perhaps come at an opportune time as he considers this year's election. Juan is just one of roughly 15 million Americans who turned 18 since the last presidential election. But to Juan, being young and politically engaged comes with responsibility.
If you come from a mixed status family and you're an American citizen, voting is not just an act of civic engagement anymore. Voting becomes an act of community service.
All right, so I'm now in the car and we're about to head out to the nearest polling location, which is only a 10-minute drive.
Juan takes the time to think about the significance of this moment. The day has come for him to cast his first ballot ever in what he believes is an election that will go down in our country's history.
A lot of people in my community, people in my family that don't have this right to vote, at least in this country. I definitely today not only voted on behalf of myself, I voted on behalf of my parents. I voted on behalf of, members of our community that need their voices to be heard.
Juan will graduate from Harvard with his degree in government and economics in 2023 and faces a critical time ahead of him. I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. For months now, cell phone carriers have been promoting 5G networks, the next generation way for you to do everything you do on your phone right now, but lots faster. This fall, the phones you need to actually make that 5G connection are finally reaching the marketplace. All of Apple's new iPhone 12 models support 5G, as do new phones from Samsung, OnePlus, and LG. But is the speed worth the price? And can you even get 5G coverage where you live? Our tech expert Omar Gayaga has heard these questions and more, and he has a few answers. Hello, Omar.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's step back for a moment. What are 5G networks? Why are they such a big deal? And what will being on one mean for the average cell phone user?
Well, if you remember like 9-10 years ago when we switched to 4G networks from 3G, I mean, the big kind of push for that was, you're going to have faster cell phone speeds, you're going to be able to move files really quickly, you're going to have more consistent phone connections and data connections. That did happen after a while, but if you remember, it was a little rough at first. It was a little inconsistent. You didn't get the speeds everywhere. And that's kind of what's happening with 5G now. These networks have been rolling out for a couple of years now, and you still can only get 5G service in certain areas, in certain large cities or counties, depending on who your carrier is. So really right now for most users, it's going to depend on, do you have a 5G phone? And if you do, are you in an area that has it? Otherwise, you're not going to see much of a difference at all.
So can regular people figure this out, whether or not they live in a 5G coverage area?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some, the actual cell phone carriers have coverage maps on their websites. The best one I've seen is on a website called Android Central, and they just updated it this month by carrier. So if you're an AT&T or Verizon or what have you, you can look up what counties and cities actually have it. And I think AT&T currently has about 30 cities and counties around Texas with 5G coverage. But then there's also different flavors of 5G. There's kind of light 5G and regular 5G. So even if you're in an area that has supposedly 5G, you might be on a kind of slower tier of 5G, depending on what network they rolled out in that area.
So if I can get 5G, I need a phone that can get it. Do I also need to switch to a different cell phone plan?
Well, it looked like that at first. Earlier this year, we were hearing rumblings that you were going to have to add like a $10 charge if you wanted 5G, or that you were going to have to get to an unlimited plan. But they kind of backed away from that. Verizon killed that idea. And I don't believe AT&T and some of the other carriers charge anything extra. So as long as you have a phone that's 5G capable, then you would get that speed without having to pay extra or switch your plan.
So we talked about how several brand new phones from several different brands are supporting 5G, but is it only for the most expensive, newest devices, or will we see moderately priced phones get 5G anytime soon?
It depends on what you consider moderate. I mean, last year we were talking about, you know, $1,000 plus cell phones. Right now, all of the iPhone 12s, as we mentioned, the Samsung Note and Galaxy S20s, the LG Velvet, the OnePlus 8T, and the Google Pixel 5 are phones that you can get. And those start in kind of the $600, $700 range. But we're starting to see 5G roll out to more budget models. And as these phones kind of age in the next year or two, as they become like the older generation of phones and still have 5G, they will definitely come down in price to the, you know, the $300, $400 range.
So what are the downfalls of 5G besides maybe not having a consistent connection? I've heard that it could be hard on your phone's battery. Is that right? And is there any way to deal with it?
Yeah, I was seeing some reports that you could lose as much as 90 minutes of battery time on an iPhone 12 using 5G, and you can turn it off if you're not, you know, in need of that. But I think that the biggest challenge 5G faces right now is just the hype of it. And there's still, you know, are you in the right area? Do you have the right device? Are you on a particular kind of 5G with a particular carrier? So it's going to be a couple of years before we really see a lot of the benefits of this. And not everyone's going to have access to it, obviously, until everybody has phones that can use it.
Omar Gayaga always connects to the fastest network as available over on TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I wish my phone was a little faster, but thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Fewer Texans are filing initial claims for jobless benefits. 33,757 people applied last week, marking a drop of more than 11,000 from the week before. Public health officials in the Lubbock area are pleading with residents to wear masks and heed social distancing protocols as coronavirus cases overwhelm local hospitals. During a virtual town hall meeting last night, Texas Tech University Chancellor Dr. Ted Mitchell warned the situation could get even worse.
I think it's really important for people to understand in Lubbock right now is that if you want a bit of a crystal ball of what things could look like, it's El Paso.
As of yesterday, COVID-19 patients account for 42% of hospitalizations in El Paso's trauma service area, according to the Texas Department of State Health Services. In the Amarillo and Lubbock areas, they make up roughly 20% of hospitalizations. The head of the Department of Homeland Security stops in the Rio Grande Valley today. As TPR's Ronaldo Leaños Jr. reports, activists plan to protest Chad Wolf's visit.
Acting Secretary Wolf and Mark Morgan, the acting commissioner for U.S. Customs and Border Protection, will celebrate the completion of 400 miles of border wall. Nearby, demonstrators will gather to protest their visit in a region where border wall construction continues, even during a pandemic that has killed more than 3,300 people in the valley. Robert Lopez with the Texas Civil Rights Project is one of the organizers of the protest.
This is nothing to celebrate. The wall leads to the deaths of migrants. It tears up indigenous lands. It takes away land from the homes of many different valley residents. So that's what this is. While these agencies are going to celebrate this, it's something to mourn for our community.
Wolf's and Morgan's visit comes a day before Senator Kamala Harris, the Democratic vice presidential candidate, is expected to be in town. Her running mate, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, has said if he's elected, border wall construction will stop. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Mission.
North Texas-based Keurig Dr. Pepper is reporting a 5.2% increase in third-quarter net sales. On a conference call today, CEO Bob Gamgort said changing consumer habits during the pandemic helped drive a 3% increase in its coffee systems business.
As people think about their homes differently, both living at home as well as working from home, they're upgrading across the board, and we're seeing a combination of new people coming into our system at a higher rate. And we're also seeing upgrades in brewers of existing consumers.
I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. The second race on the ballot for Texans this election is for U.S. Senate. Republican incumbent John Cornyn is facing a challenge from former combat veteran Democrat M.J. Hagar. Big issues in that race have included the pandemic, the spiraling economy, and ongoing calls for social and racial justice. Because of that, how the candidates stand on guns has been overshadowed. From KERA North Texas, Hadi Mawagdi looks at what both Cornyn and Hagar have said about firearms and why, despite everything else going on, the issue is still important.
Around this time last year, after shootings in El Paso and Odessa left 31 people dead and dozens of others injured, limiting gun rights was top of mind for some Texas politicians.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
That's former El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke speaking at a Democratic presidential debate last September. That line probably wouldn't get the same response today, even from people who generally agree with some of O'Rourke's views on guns.
Hi, y'all. I'm Will, and I am a liberal gun owner. I'm not just a gun owner. I'm a gun nut.
That's Will Hancock from Kingwood, Texas, on his YouTube page. And while he talks about guns all the time, it's not what he or people he knows are thinking about as Election Day approaches.
Other things are more important. You know, healthcare, taxes. I mean, there are so many other things at stake.
That's understandable, says Ed Scruggs.
COVID-19 has changed so many things because there's so many immediate emergency issues that come into play.
Scruggs is from the nonpartisan group Texas Gun Sense, which advocates for evidence-based policies that they believe will reduce gun injuries and deaths. In the U.S. Senate race in Texas, where incumbent Republican John Cornyn is facing Democratic challenger M.J. Hagar, Scruggs points out it initially looked like guns would be a major issue.
MJ Hagar came out strong in support of gun violence prevention policies from the beginning. It was an issue in her primary and in her runoff. And some people believe that was an issue and an advantage that she had, and one reason she won the nomination.
Hagar, Scruggs says, has staked out a moderate position on the issue. She supports a ban on the sale of assault-style rifles, and Hagar wants to close loopholes in the background check system. In an interview with KERA, Hagar called her opponent's views on guns extreme.
Universal background checks would have saved lives in Midland that day, and they know that it would save lives. So I don't accept that John Cornyn thinks he's done enough. He knows he hasn't, but he is trying to serve his corporate PAC donors over his constituents.
KERA reached out to Senator Cornyn and his campaign for an interview, but he declined. When I shared Hagar's sentiment with Cornyn's representative, they pointed to the Fix NICS Act, which Cornyn successfully pushed through the Senate in 2018. It provides new financial incentives to states and agencies to report violent criminals to the FBI's background check system. His office told KERA that the senator considers the Fix NICS Act to be, quote, the accomplishment he's most proud of. Ed Scruggs from Texas Gun Sense says over the past 18 years, Senator Cornyn's toed the line when it comes to gun legislation.
His actions on gun violence prevention are very limited.
Cornyn has not come out in favor of universal background checks and has voted against banning high-capacity magazines over 10 bullets. And all of that has earned him an A-plus rating from the NRA. Still, firearms have barely come up in Cornyn and Hagar's campaign in 2020. Or in any 2020 campaign. But experts say, especially right now, pushing gun issues aside is an error of judgment. Here's Dr. Fliegler from Boston Children's Hospital.
We know that firearms are responsible for 20% of the fatalities of youth in America, and that they're responsible for almost 40,000 deaths in our country. These are deaths that are not necessary.
Fliegler is bringing attention to the high number of guns purchased during the pandemic.
Increased anxiety, increased depression, and firearms truly have the potential to increase gun violence, specifically around suicide.
He thinks politicians turning their attention away from gun policy issues right now is a mistake, one that is surely going to lead to more losses, and not just political ones. I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
A lawsuit says census supervisors pressured census workers in several states, including Texas, to falsify data. The National Urban League, the City of San Jose, California, and others claim some household forms were marked as completed after only one attempt to reach residents. According to the Associated Press, the suit claims some census takers said supervisors pressured them to close cases as quickly as possible, sometimes by guessing how many people lived at a location. The lawsuit claims this was done so the census could be wrapped up as quickly as possible while Donald Trump was still in office, regardless of the outcome of the election.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Horror fans call it a classic. Others point to its influence in the slasher genre of films. Still others just say, no thanks. 46 years ago this month, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre unleashed seismic reactions in moviegoers that still resonate today, and its connection is intricately linked, of course, to the Lone Star State for obvious reasons. Now, with another reboot of the film scheduled, we decided to ask Lars Nilsson from the Austin Film Society to talk with us about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre's significance. Lars, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much.
So confession time, I'm kind of a wimp when it comes to horror films, and I only just saw this one. Can you recall the first time you saw it?
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw it, and there had been a lot of trepidation on my part to ever watch it. And I think probably a lot of people feel this. I mean, It seemed to me like this is the ultimate, this is going to be the bloodiest movie you've ever seen. And so I was a little surprised to watch it. And the fact that it's really not a very bloody film. And in fact, maybe the blood that people most remember is like one guy cutting his own hand, you know, cutting his own finger. It's like there's just not that much flowing blood in the film. So, but it does deserve its reputation, and it was banned all over the world. You know, everyone sort of looked at this film, which I think is as this incredibly frightening film, which it is. And I think that's really a testament to the filmmaking because it's a really exceptionally made film. But yeah, just watching it, I had that reaction where I was scared to death, you know, watching it on a little TV, but at the same time, kind of in awe of just what a well-made film it is that didn't rely on, you know, buckets and buckets of blood.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. Kristen Cabrera, our producer, said the exact same thing. She just watched the film for the first time and was surprised at how not bloody it was. But I wonder if one thing that makes it scary is sort of the verbiage surrounding this film, that it was based on true events. Do you think that's true? And can you clear that up for us?
Yeah, it was not based on true events. But and any of us could now get on our phone and look it up and see that it was not based on true events. However, when this came out, people didn't have Snopes or, you know, some fact-checking place that they could look. They believed it was based on a true event. And you can imagine just as it gets weirder and darker,
right,
to think that, like, oh, my God, this really happened someplace. That really, I think that that's sort of an underrated aspect of why this film did scare the hell out of people when it came out, is that they thought that this had really happened somehow.
Yeah, and that it happened in Texas, which, as you say, wasn't true at all. But there are elements of Texas and like Texas stereotypes, kind of let's say cooked in there. Could you talk about some of those and what makes this kind of a Texas-y film?
Well, it's not only is it a Texas-y film; it's an Austin-y film.
Mm.
I mean, yes, it's Texas-y. These are people who were presumably in the cattle trade at some point, and there's butchery going on, and there's when we do look outside of Austin, it's like that. A lot of these sort of surrounding communities around the Chisholm Trail, let's say, these are cattle communities. 100 or more years ago, you would have seen the cattle trade as being the industry, and I think that when you see all the bones and the butchery, like that's kind of these pioneer families that had lived there for years and years and years, and in fact to become a bit inbred, let's say, you know, which is one of the more sort of outre components of this. But the heroes are Austinites. They're used to this sort of cosmopolitan life of Austin, this sort of, if you will, to use today's vernacular, kind of this blue island surrounded by red. And, you know, they're venturing out outside of Austin, outside of this sort of little bubble of liberality and cosmopolitanism into this old Texas. And you can imagine that at the time for these people, and, you know, Toby at the time he made the film was 30 years old, relatively young. These are all young folks who were kind of dope smokers in Austin at the time, cosmic cowboys in a way, to mm-hmm. sort of venture outside of this must have been fairly terrifying to like just go through these communities. And remember, this is a time when Nixon had just, you know, won by a huge landslide. So Austin really was in this very sort of stark relief, being a blue island in the middle of this red sea of Texas, even more so than today when, you know, Texas is a little more purple. But that's that element of it being an Austin film about this sort of these future dwellers of Austin venturing into this kind of decaying past, I think, is one of the most fascinating aspects of the film.
Now, if you're trying to do research on it, or you're trying to even just look it up to watch it on your streaming service, and you put in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you're going to come up with like several results. I mean, this movie has been remade and reimagined a few different times. How does that Texas role sort of play or transform, or have you seen these different remakes to have any comparison?
Well, I've seen the sequel that Toby made, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which is just it's a howl. It's really terrific and has very little to do with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's a horror comedy and it's a blast. I haven't seen a lot of the other sort of remakes and so forth.
Now, there is a new reboot coming. Are there any hopes for this one that it will, you know, kind of take what made the first one special and move it forward? Or what have you heard about it?
I think it would be, I mean, I wish them the best of luck. I hope they do a great job with it. I'm sure that they know what a hard task it is. But I think the original is so special because of the place that it came out of, the sort of context with Toby Hooper being determined to make an art film out of this. I would be surprised if the people making a reboot of a 2020 reboot of Texas Chainsaw Massacre are trying to make an art film. You know, I just don't think they probably are. And I think that's a big difference. The title, proven winner again and again and again. So I suspect that they're going to use the title and it's going to feel like a very different movie.
Toby Hooper, you're talking about, actually wrote, directed, and co-produced this film. You said he was setting out to make an art film. Do you feel like he was successful in that?
Yeah, I think Texas Chainsaw Massacre is an art film, and I think Toby was very successful in making that art film. And let's remember that he came from this context of Austin, where he was able to go to the cinema and watch Antonioni films and Fellini films and Bergman films. And he set out as a conscious choice. He always said this in interviews, that he was making an art film. And I think you see it in everything that he does, in the choice of music and the choice of some of the insert shots, which are quite experimental sometimes, that it is an art film. In fact, he went about it with a lot more care than most people making a slasher or a horror movie would, working around the clock, driving his cast and crew insane. Most of them hated him after shooting the film because he spent so much care on it. And that's the thing that you don't do if you're just trying to turn a quick buck making a horror movie. Spending that much care is something that you do when you really are setting out to make something special, which he was.
Lars Nilsson is with the Austin Film Society. Lars, happy Halloween.
Thank you so much.
So what do you think? Like scary movies or not so much? You can tell us what you think. Email us at texasstandard@kut.org or find us on social media.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. To aid early detection, all women over the age of 40 should undergo routine screening, like yearly mammograms. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard, and I'm Bianca Lisa Perez with the Typewriter Rodeo, and I make up poems on the spot. Terlingua, Texas, December 21st, 2019. Give me a minute longer to collect the blanket from the white dirt. I don't care what the stars say. I am nothing but a ball of burning skin in close proximity to neither sky or the center of this hard, hot planet. This is the first time I am meeting the dust in my bones and the atoms of Eve's womb. Look how they fall down, still trying to find paradise, an oasis bowl between the mountains. I'm Bianca Lisa Perez with Typewriter Rodeo, and you're listening to Texas Standard.
Listen to the Typewriter Rodeo each week on The Standard or wherever you get your podcasts, and send us your poem requests at texasstandard@kut.org. And I know what you're thinking. No, it's not yet Friday, but it is time now for the week that was in Texas politics. We're doing this all a day early because we have a special show tomorrow. We hope you'll join us as we mark the impact of COVID-19 and recognize Dia de los Muertos. Ofrenda, a decimation of people, a celebration of life, is Friday on Texas Standard Time. Right now, I'm joined by Ross Ramsey, executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. Ross, good to talk with you again.
Good to see you again, or talk to you again.
Right now, there's been some back and forth in the courts this week about masks, no masks. Where do things stand now?
No masks. The San Antonio federal judge earlier this week said that you do have to wear a mask to vote in response to a lawsuit. The Fifth Circuit put that aside, and for now, you do not have to wear a mask to vote in Texas.
All right. Still a good idea, though, according to the experts. Earlier this week, the Texas Army National Guard said troops will be deployed ahead of the November 3rd election. At first, we got very little clarification on this from Governor Greg Abbott. Do we know more now?
Yeah, they're saying it's a coincidence that it's not tied to the election and that the National Guard troops will not be at the polls, that they're not being dispersed for the elections, but for general, just to watch crowds and things like that. The governor's office deferred calls to the National Guard and said it started over there, but they're basically saying this is not an election watch program.
But they're doing it on Election Day, right?
Yeah, the timing is clear, you know, and it begs for speculation. I won't do that, but they're saying that it's not going to be tied to actually going to the polls and watching people vote. So, you know, they're watching for something. I'm not sure exactly what, 1,000 troops across the state.
And they haven't made any indication of what has prompted them to do this. They haven't made clear any like specific threat or anything that they're watching for.
No, they haven't. I mean, there's been talk all over the place about, you know, this group or that group might say something or have something to say or demonstrate on election night. But, you know, we're into the land of speculation there, and they're not saying anything concrete.
Finally, Texas Land Commissioner George P. Bush has hinted he'll run for attorney general. When and where did he say that?
You know, you wouldn't want the 2020 election to get in the way of the 2022 election, would you? He was asked if he would run for attorney general, and he said, basically, I'm not ruling anything out, which is the same as saying, okay, I'm dropping the hockey puck, let's play. You're going to see a lot of this, particularly right after this election. We've got a bunch of statewide elected officials in the Republican Party who are all ambitious and are friendly, but they're all looking up and they're all curious about what the governor's going to do, what the lieutenant governor's going to do, what Ken Paxton's going to do, the attorney general, and they're sort of jockeying for the next rung on the ladder, and that's 2022. I think the next election cycle starts on Wednesday.
All right. Well, we've still got one day left for early voting. Election day, of course, next Tuesday. Any last thoughts before we head that out?
You know, turnout is really big. You know, I've been telling people that if you wait until Tuesday, you're betting on good weather and short lines, and that's not probably a great bet.
All right. Ross Ramsey is executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. Ross, thank you.
Take care.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is back now. He's been tracking what Texans are talking about. Wells, what are you seeing out there?
Hey, Laura. Perhaps unsurprisingly, but yes, voting continuing to dominate discussion on social media. And just that stunning turnout that we're seeing. Seeing reports that Texas has either reached or is either on track or is or has already eclipsed the total number of ballots cast in 2018, just wow. In this early voting period. So honestly, or obviously, a huge story, just this turnout and scrambling projections for what it may mean come Election Day. Well, as we heard, some folks, most people voting early that we're seeing on the Texas Standard Facebook page, but some people say they will hold out for Election Day proper. Hina Shaw says she's planning to vote on Election Day alongside her 19-year-old, who will be voting in her first presidential election.
That's exciting.
It certainly is. And I really liked this as well from Todd Gernert. He sent in a photo of three generations voting together, his family all hitting the polls there early on early voting. What people are voting for, this interesting comment from Bill Holston. He says, I voted for asylum seekers stuck in Matamoros. I voted for the rights of my LGBT friends to live their authentic lives. I voted for my Black siblings and their safety and security. And he adds that he voted the first day. So obviously lots of people fired up out there by this election. And we're not the only ones. You know, obviously Texans have been hitting the polls in record numbers. And I think we're on record to get the number of Texas write-ups in the national media, because it is attracting a lot of attention.
Yeah,
the headline here in the
attention.
New York Times. Yeah, New York Times headline, Texas is a toss-up, so why won't Trump or Biden campaign there? Begging the question there, although we are, as you and I have discussed, Laura, going to see Kamala Harris here later in the week, and several Biden surrogates crisscrossing the state in a bus soon. But interesting commentary here from one of the authors, Jim Martin at the New York Times. Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke agree on something. Texas is in play. So obviously, watch this. Going to make for a real interesting election night.
It will. Well, and it's hard to tell. I think a lot of people feeling very anxious about that, you know, whether we know results very early, whether it takes a long time. I think people already sort of preparing to question those results. But, you know, maybe that depends on what the results say and how you feel about them. So just
a lot of underlying anxiety.
Yeah.
A lot of discussion, too, like on Twitter, especially, you know, it's a very sort of a news-centric and media-centric website. But a lot of discussion, too, about the role of the media and what is proper and what can be expected on election night, because we've seen so much from the president, yet another Twitter user, there, you know, demanding that we have results quickly, that we, you know, have a winner on election night. And traditionally, that's just not the way it's gone down. It takes a long time, especially with this turnout. So a lot to please for not prematurely calling things on election night, I'm seeing out there.
Agree. And thinking, you know, it's a good time just to remind everybody, breathe and control the things that you can control, which is casting your ballot. And if you haven't done that yet, you still have today, you have Friday, and then you have Election Day. And we hope you'll join us back here for a special show tomorrow. See you then.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.